Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is May 17th. This is your last lecture today. It's going to be on diversification system. And here's the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. So, the only session after this one, I guess there's a couple labs left today, but Wednesday's lab, I believe you're done. Because it starts finals week, Wednesday. So, today are the last labs. And your final in here is on May 24th. That is a Tuesday. Oh, it's not a Tuesday. Monday. Okay, Monday. That's a week from today. Week from today, Monday. Because today's Monday. All right, so it's going to cover chapters 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, and 24. All right, so, but some of those are really short chapters. All right, make sure you use the study guide, end of chapter questions, online questions, study figures, those kinds of things. So here is a sign-in sheet for today, and I've got the final exam on there. The 24th is your last exam. All right, so last time we stopped the lecture when I asked you a question. What's the purpose of the human reproductive system? And a lot of people said, oh, to reproduce. And I'm going to say that I probably don't, well, I don't agree with that. What's the function of the reproductive system? I mean, it's so complicated. Look at all the stuff we got to talk about. We got the hypothalamus, the anterior pituitary, all these different gonads and germ cells and follicles. And let's see, we got the clitoris and penis and uterus and ovaries and all that kind of stuff. Why is it so complicated? How does that possibly benefit humankind? What's the purpose of the reproductive system? Okay, and the answer to me is as plain as the nose on your face. So if you were to look around at every student in class right now, okay, if you just look around, do you see another you anywhere? Do you see another you anywhere in class? No. Okay, you all look different, at least in class. Now if you go out and walk around campus and you walk around all day long, are you going to find another you? No. Okay, and so to me, that's really what the function of the reproductive system is to produce new and unique individuals, somebody different. We call that diversification. All right, and another way of thinking of this is at one point in time, your mom and dad joined together to form you. All right, is it possible for your mom, say they're still alive, is it possible today for your mom and dad to form another you? And you know what? The answer is yes, it is possible. But has it ever happened? Probably not, right? Because it is just, the odds of that happening are just so remote. It's billions and billions and billions to one, right? So it definitely is possible for your mom and dad to form another you, but it just has never happened, okay? Maybe at one time there could be identical twins, but that's just from one fertilization event. All right, so now, there are some organisms that don't reproduce sexually, like sea anemones. They're little animals that live in the ocean, and lots of other organisms. They can just grow an organism right off the side of their body, and as it gets bigger and bigger, it breaks away and starts to grow as an independent organism. Okay? And what would be the difference from that parent anemone and the new baby anemone? They would be exactly the same. They would be like clones of each other. Okay, but because we are all different, that has some major implications in terms of evolution and how fit we are as a species. That means that if there's, for instance, if there's swine flu going around, will we all get sick?
No,
because our population is diverse, because everybody's different that way, right? So we're not all susceptible to the same kinds of diseases. But we did mention one disease when we talked about bones. That will affect everybody as we get older, if we're lucky enough to live old enough. What is osteoporosis? And that's why I mention it, because it's such a strange disease that we all have to deal with that as we get older, especially females. All right, we're going to talk about another disease process today in terms of the male, that every male will have to face as they get older. And again, that is strange. Why is that strange that every male will have to face this pathological process as they get older?
Gray hair.
Well, gray hair, okay. That's not necessarily pathological, okay. But I'm not asking for the disease. I'm asking why is it strange that every man in the population will have to face this if they're lucky enough to live long enough. Why is that strange? Are there a lot of disease processes that will affect everybody in the population? No, only very, very few. And the reason why it's strange is strange because we're a diverse population. Okay? All right, so I want to start talking about the reproductive system. Oh, but I do want to just do a little quick public service announcement, and that is this Baby Safe LA program didn't start in California, right? It started in Texas. And this is just a program, some of you might not be aware of it, and I wish that not to be a secret. And this just says that if somebody has a newborn baby, and if they don't want the baby, and if they can't take care of it, they can give it up for adoption by taking it to any fire station or hospital, and there will be no repercussions against them if that happens, right? Because I'm always horrified when I hear of babies being found in dumpsters and things like that when parents, right, unfortunately just kill their newborn babies because they can't take care of them. And of course, having a baby is a very stressful circumstance. If you don't have a lot of family support, it's just really, really hard on new parents, right? So I give you the website, and you can pass that word around. And I think this semester, at least two babies were found in L.A. County, okay, murdered as a result of that. So that really doesn't have to happen if people are educated and know how to deal with that circumstance. All right, so raise your hand if you'd heard of this program before. A lot of people. Not everybody. Okay, so I'm glad I mentioned it. Pass that around to everybody you know. Okay. All right, so let's start talking about the male reproductive system. Okay. Well, there's a primary and then secondary reproductive structures. So the primary reproductive structure is the testes. All right, that's responsible for making sperm and secreting some hormones, in particular testosterone. And then testosterone is the male sex hormone, and that promotes the development and maintenance of the secondary reproductive structures in the male, like the scrotum and the penis and all these other different structures, plus other male sex characteristics compared to female, like coarser hair, more muscle mass, bigger, denser, thicker bones. Okay, that's what testosterone is responsible for. All right, so let's take a look at the male reproductive system. Okay, so here's a pretty good exam figure. And we see the testes right here, right? That's in the scrotum, that's outside the pelvic cavity. That's going to be unlike the female reproductive system, where the primary reproductive structure is an ovary that's inside the pelvic cavity. So there's a reason why in the male the testes is in the scrotum, and that is because the process of spermatogenesis is inhibited by normal body temperature. It has to be lower than that. It has to be cooler in order for the male to produce viable sperm that are motile. Now, why are sperm motile? What kind of organelles did we learn that provide for motility of a particular cell? A flagellum and cilia, but it's a sperm that has a flagellum, a single flagellum. That's the only human cell that does have a flagellum. All right, so those are produced in the testes right here. And the testes are in the scrotum, and it's a little bit cooler in the scrotum. We'll see how that is in just a little bit. Okay. And so the testes produce sperm. They are stored in the epididymis, which is a small coiled tube around the posterior side of the testes right here, and sperm go there to undergo their final stages of maturation. All right, and then during ejaculation, sperm move from the epididymis into the vas deferens. Sometimes we call that the ductus deferens, which then moves through the spermatic cord, and I'll tell you what makes up the spermatic cord, and it enters the pelvic cavity via this inguinal canal. That's a hole in the body wall. And it moves over the superior and anterior part of the urinary bladder. As it proceeds posteriorly, right, it starts to move inferiorly, and it passes through the seminal vesicles right here. There are three glands that add volume to the ejaculate, and the seminal vesicles are one of them. Right, as the vas deferens passes through the seminal vesicle, it becomes the ampulla, which means it's a little swelling of the vas deferens. All right, and then it enters the second organ that adds volume to the ejaculate, which is the prostate gland right here. And as it enters the prostate gland, then we change the name of the vas deferens. It becomes the ejaculatory duct. And of course, how many testes does a normal person have? Two. How many vas deferens does a normal person have? There's actually two. One coming from each testy, right? There's nothing right on midline. They're bilateral, off to the side, and they move through the prostate. So guess how many ejaculatory ducts there are? There are two ejaculatory ducts passing through the prostate gland. Okay. So here's that ejaculatory duct. And again, the prostate gland adds volume to the ejaculate. And now we see the joining of the reproductive tract, namely the ejaculatory duct, and the urethra, which is coming from the urinary bladder. That happens right inside the prostate gland. All right, so from here all the way to the outside world is the urethra. All right, so we don't ever call it the ejaculatory duct or vas deferens anymore. So this is a common structure that is taking ejaculate as well as urine to the outside world via this external urethral orifice right here. So in the male, the reproductive system and the urinary system join together right here to form a common duct. And you're going to see that that never happens in the female, all right? At least in the human female. In other species, that's not true. Okay, and then the third gland is this bulbourethral gland right here. That adds volume to the ejaculate as well. All right, so here is a disease process that will affect every man if they're lucky enough to live long enough, and that is this prostate gland, as we get older, hypertrophies, means it gets bigger. It gets larger and larger all the time, and as it gets bigger, it kind of squishes down everything, right, because it can't get too big, and so it starts to block the ejaculatory duct, and it starts to block the urethra. And if the urethra is blocked, then what can't you do? Yeah, you can't void the urinary bladder right here, or you can't pee, okay? And then you're in a little bit of difficulty because sometimes when this prostate gets bigger, sometimes it's a benign process, it just gets bigger. Other times it becomes cancerous. And you can't tell just by taking a picture of it with an MRI unit or palpating it with a fingertip or something like that. You have to take a biopsy and look at it, look at the histology, look at the cell types. Okay, so that's kind of a funny problem. I kind of think of that as like being like osteoporosis, right? As every woman gets older, they have to be concerned about brittle bones. As every male gets older, they have to worry about prostate cancer or prostate hypertrophy, benign prostate hypertrophy. Okay, now why is that such a strange process that every person is going to come down with one or the other of those diseases? Why is that so strange? Because of diversity, because we're all so different in here, but yet those are two processes that will happen to everybody if you're lucky enough to live long enough. Okay. All right, so the penis has got some structures, all right? It kind of looks like a sponge right here, and that means that it can fill up with blood and it can maintain an erection. All right, so this is the dorsal surface or posterior surface of the penis. Right, posterior surface, and here is the anterior surface of the penis, or ventral. Right? And just, you might be wondering, well, why is it like that? Well, because the penis right now is not really in anatomic position. Right? It would make sense, of course, if the penis was erect. Right? And then you would have the ventral surface here and the dorsal surface up over here. So view it that way. All right, so in the ventral surface, we have the corpus spongiosum. And that is just one body. And running through the corpus spongiosum is the urethra. So sometimes we call that the spongy urethra. Sometimes we call it the penile urethra. It's really the same thing. All right. There's another part of the urethra as it goes through the perineum right here. Sometimes we call this the membranous urethra. And then the urethra that goes through the prostate gland, we call that the prostatic urethra. So remember, blood vessels change their name depending on what part of the body they're in. It's the exact same tube, but the name changes. The same thing for the urethra. Part of the corpus spongiosum is the glans penis right here. And the glans penis is protected by the foreskin or the prepuce right here. Okay, the other erectile tissue that we have in the penis is like I said, in this posterior or dorsal part of the penis. That's the corpus cavernosum. And there are two. There are two that are next to each other. So these are bilateral structures. I'll have to show you a little bit different view of this. All right, so I think we're done with this particular picture right here. All right, so this shows it. Here is a nice cross-section of the penis. Here is a corpus spongiosum. And what's that tube that's going right through the middle of the corpus spongiosum? That's the urethra. Yeah, the spongy urethra or penile urethra. And then here are the two corpora cavernosa. Corpora is plural for corpus, right? And cavernosa is plural for both of them. And you can see some arteries and veins in here as well. All right, so we also see that we reflect back some of the tissue from the scrotum, and we can see the testes right here with the epididymis around it, and the connection between this testes and the pelvic cavity we see right in this compartment right here, and that's what we call the spermatic cord. So the spermatic cord is attached to the testes, and let's list the things that we find in that spermatic cord. Of course, there is that tube that takes sperm from the testes into the pelvic cavity. What did we call that tube? Vas deferens, that's one. And of course, this testes needs oxygen and nutrients. What's bringing oxygen and nutrients to this testes right here? The testicular artery is part of the spermatic cord as well. So we got vas deferens and testicular artery. All right. Now, that testicular artery is bringing blood to this testes right here at normal body temperature, which is 98.6. But we said that spermatogenesis can't happen correctly at that temperature. All right, so there has to be some kind of structure that cools the blood before it gets to the testes. And here is a pretty nifty heat exchange mechanism, kind of like the radiator that you have in your car. All right, so can you see a red blood vessel in there anywhere? Maybe, all right, you're lucky if you can. I can't quite see it, but it's in there somewhere. That's the testicular artery. And then look at this blue blood vessel right here. It's a network of veins that we call the pampiniform plexus. And blood is returning back to the heart, of course, via these veins. And this blood has been in the scrotum for a fairly long period of time. So guess what the temperature of the blood is in the pampiniform plexus? It's cooler, all right? And it flows over the testicular arteries, and guess which way heat likes to flow? It likes to flow from hot to cold. From hot to cold. Okay? And so, as the hot blood in this testicular artery flows down to the testes, it's cooled by this cold blood in the pampiniform plexus, and therefore the testes, the function of the testes, right, is maintained and spermatogenesis takes place. All right, so let's review the structure so far. We've got the vas deferens, we've got the testicular artery, the testicular vein, sometimes we call that the pampiniform plexus, right, that make up the spermatic cord, and then one other thing, and that is the testicular nerve that goes to the testes. That's what makes this spermatic cord. All right, there's something else that surrounds the spermatic cord, and that is this muscle right here that's called the cremaster muscle. All right, so that also helps suspend the testes so it doesn't get lost. Okay. All right, so here you can see the spermatic cord. So you should know all of those things in there. There is another muscle around the scrotum, and that's called the dartos muscle. I don't know which ones of those you have to know. You have to just look at your list of muscles to know. All right, so, oh, here's the testicular nerve. You can see the testicular nerve nicely in this diagram right here. Okay. All right, so here's the testes, and there are a bunch of microscopic coiled tubes that we call the seminiferous tubules. Can't see these with your naked eye, but in these tubules, this is where spermatogenesis takes place. All right, and then there's also some tissue that's outside the seminiferous tubules, which we call the that interstitial space. So if we cut a seminiferous tubule, it kind of looks like this. And if you look really close, you can see some spermatocytes that have flagellum on them. And they come from germ cells, right? And these germ cells produce spermatocytes by a process we call meiosis. We don't go into meiosis very much in here. And there are other cells called Sertoli cells that help the sperms mature from germ cells to healthy spermatocytes. The cells that are between the seminiferous tubules, the interstitial cells, those are very important as well because they are the ones that secrete testosterone. Right? And the spermatocytes will only mature if these interstitial cells are secreting testosterone and the Sertoli cells are supplying nutrients for their maturation. All right, so these sperm aren't mature when they're in the seminiferous tubule. Where do they have to go to gain their complete function? They have to go to a particular tube outside the testes, and that is the epididymis. So here I see the epididymis. Oh, I clicked the button again. Sorry. All right. So how do they get from seminiferous tubule to this epididymis right here? All right. So they have to pass through a straight tubule, which we have right here, and then through the Reedy's testes right here. That's another network of tubules, and then into an efferent ductule, and then finally into the epididymis. So that's the pathway sperm have to take to find their way outside the body. Okay, and, well, here's a pretty interesting slide because we can see these spermatocytes or spermatozoa as they're developing. And this right here, that looks like yellow to me. Does that look like yellow? Okay, so right here, what I'm outlining is one cell, and that is the Sertoli cell that nourishes these spermatocytes as they're maturing into mature sperm. Okay. And then here is the stem cell, or the germ cell, that is going to eventually become a sperm cell. And that's in the outer lining of... Okay, now where are these cells located? Where are these cells located? They're in the testes. But what part of the testes? Look up over here.
Middle.
Okay, close. It's in a lobule, and the lobules are made up of these tubules right here. And this is what we call a seminiferous tubule. All right, so here is the lumen of the seminiferous tubule right here, and then here is the wall of the seminiferous tubule right here. All right, and then the lumen empties into the Reedy's testes, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so what do I want to say? What did I forget to say about any of these? You might learn that the interstitial cells, all right, are sometimes called cells of Leydig. A Leydig cell and an interstitial cell are the same thing, but most importantly, what does it secrete? Testosterone, and where do we find those interstitial cells? They're in the interstitial spaces between the seminiferous tubules, or outside the seminiferous tubules, and they secrete, once again, they secrete testosterone, right? And then that testosterone enables this Sertoli cell to do its job, so that spermatocytes can mature into viable spermatozoa. So that's pretty much it for the male reproductive system. So know the two kinds of erectile tissue in the penis, where it's located, okay? And which one has two parts? And which one has one part? Which one has two? The cavernosa has two parts. And the erectile tissue, which you only have one of, is the spongiosum, plus the spongiosum has what else going through it? The urethra, and so we call it the spongy urethra. Okay. Okay, and you can read about the product of the various glands, the prostate gland and the seminal vesicles and the bulbourethral gland. They all secrete something that neutralizes acid, because acid will negatively affect spermatozoa, will decrease their motility, and the male urethra and the female vagina is too acidic to maintain normal motility of those sperm. Okay. All right, so let's look at the female reproductive tract. Oh, here's another good, before we leave the male, here's another good view that shows the two corpora cavernosa and the singular corpus spongiosum right here. All right, so this might be an exempt figure. Here's a cross-section of the corpora cavernosa, corpus spongiosum. All right, the testes, epididymis, vas deferens, moving through the seminal vesicles. And what does the vas deferens become as it moves through the seminal vesicles and into the prostate gland? It's called the ejaculatory duct, right? So you got two ejaculatory ducts. Here's that prostate gland, and now we've got the prostatic urethra, membranous urethra, and spongy urethra right here. Okay, so that's a pretty good diagram of all this. All right, that takes us to the female reproductive tract. And one thing that you notice right away is here is the urinary bladder. So I'm not even talking about the reproductive tract. I'm talking about the urinary system, right? And then what's the tube that leads from the urinary bladder to the outside world? That is the urethra. Here is the urethra. Here's the external urethral orifice. And notice that the urethra and the female reproductive tract never join together. It's always separate, right? So that's important for controlling infection of the reproductive system, and especially during pregnancy. But not just during pregnancy, but you don't want an infection of the reproductive tract even if you're not pregnant, right? So that's a good thing to have that urethra separate from the reproductive system. All right, the primary reproductive structure in the female is the ovary right here. And the function of the ovary is to produce some hormones as well as the gametes, which are the counterparts to sperm. What do we call the counterpart to sperm in the female? That would be an egg or an oocyte. All right, and unlike a sperm, those oocytes do not have cilia, and they do not have flagellum. Well, a sperm doesn't have cilia anyway, but a sperm has flagellum. All right, so this ovary right here will ovulate an egg, and since it doesn't have any organelles for motility, where does it go? It will just float around whichever way fluid is moving in the pelvic cavity. And remember, there's nothing that separates the pelvic cavity from the abdominal cavity, so that egg can float around anywhere in the abdominal cavity or pelvic cavity. It's just floating. It's going with the flow. Okay. But fortunately, here is a structure that does have flow associated with it. This is called the fallopian tube or uterine tube. All right, and the opening right here is kind of like a big funnel, and it has this fimbriated edge. It has like these little fingers or a very lacy edge. These fingers are sweeping over the ovary all the time. And inside the fallopian tube and these fimbria, all of these cells are ciliated. And guess which way all those cilia are beating? Toward the uterus or away from the uterus? Toward the uterus. So after the ovary ovulates an egg, that egg gets trapped in the flow that goes into the uterus right here. So that egg enters through the infundibulum, okay, makes its way down the fallopian tube, usually toward the uterus. All right, so don't forget about these fimbriated edges right here. It's a very delicate, lacy kind of tissue. And that ciliated epithelium is fairly delicate tissue as well. And the fallopian tube is a fairly delicate structure, doesn't have a lot of muscle associated with it, and these structures are sensitive to infection. All right, so any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease will cause scarring of the fallopian tube. Maybe it might not block the fallopian tube, but it might decrease the function of those cilia. Right, and if those cilia aren't beating, what happens to that egg? It just floats around in the pelvic cavity. Or it might get trapped in the fallopian tube and not make its way to the uterus right here. Or it might even end up in the abdominal cavity. All right, so that's what might happen to an egg. But now what about sperm that are here in the vagina? What happens to them? Well, they can swim around anywhere, right? Because they have a flagellum, they can swim in the external cervical orifice right here, which is what we call the external os, through the cervical canal, out the internal os, through the lumen of the uterus and through the fallopian tube and out the end of the fallopian tube. We call this the infundibulum, this wide opening of the fallopian tube. And of course, sperm can swim where? Anywhere in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity. And if they bump into an egg, guess what can happen? Fertilization can happen, right? And then that blastocyst will try to implant like it would normally in the uterus. It will implant maybe in the fallopian tube or maybe into the mesentery of small intestine or large intestine or even the body cavity someplace. All right, and as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, since there is no strong muscle holding it in location like it does in the uterus right here, look how big and strong this uterus is right here that can maintain a pregnancy. Since that implantation doesn't have that muscle holding it in, guess what's going to happen? That fetus or developing embryo will break away from its blood supply and cause a massive hemorrhage within the peritoneal cavity. And that can be fatal within just a number of minutes. And so that's a pretty serious condition. What do we call that condition? That's called an ectopic pregnancy, right? So who's at risk for an ectopic pregnancy? Anybody that's had any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease, which causes scarring of the fallopian tube right here, right? So any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease, maybe if you get a bladder infection and it's not treated properly, that can migrate to the reproductive system right here. So you got to take all of those infections pretty seriously. Okay, so ectopic pregnancies are, unless diagnosed and treated, right, they usually end up in a fatality of the developing embryo as well as the mother as well. So that's really, really serious. And for years and years, in emergency rooms, that used to be missed as an important diagnosis. All right, and somebody would come in with some abdominal pain or discomfort, and the physician would kind of, you know, poke and prod and ask some questions and say, well, you know what, I can't tell if it's something you ate or maybe it's appendicitis or maybe colitis or something. I tell you what, take a couple aspirin and come back and see me in the morning if the pain persists. And guess what could happen overnight? And it did happen a lot. Women would hemorrhage to death as a result of that. And so to help physicians, they would hang signs in the emergency room, and the signs would say, think ectopic, so that that condition would be diagnosed, right? And so that was a difficult diagnosis to make. But now it's relatively easy because everybody's aware of it. So if somebody comes to the emergency room with pelvic pain, what are some of the questions that maybe should be running through your mind? Or if you have a friend, okay, what are some questions that should be running through your mind? Well, is it a woman, right? Number one. Number two, are they during their childbearing years? Are they, right, are they reproductive? Are they in a reproductive time in their life? Are they sexually active, right? And if you get yeses to all that, then you have to ask, well, do you have any history of pelvic inflammatory disease, right? Any kind of infections of the reproductive tract? And if all those questions are yes, then you got to take that really seriously and start measuring some hormone levels and maybe even looking at some imaging studies for ultrasound to find out if they are pregnant and where that pregnancy is. Okay, because that still happens quite a bit. I don't have any data how often that happens in the United States, but it happens pretty way too frequently. Okay, so here we got the uterus. This is where normal implantation takes place. And we got some layers of the uterus you should be aware of. The outer layer, that is the perimetrium. The innermost layer right here is the endometrium. And then all the muscle right here is what we call the myometrium, right? The myometrium. And the cervix contains a lot of myometrium. That's a very, very, very strong muscle, right? And the cervix pokes down a little bit, protrudes into the vagina. So there's a little rim right here. That rim we call the fornices. There's an anterior fornix, there's a posterior fornix, and then there are two lateral fornices. But remember, it's a ring that completely encircles the dome of the cervix right here. All right, then the vagina, okay, that accepts penis and sperm. It also is an important birth canal. It's another function of the vagina, and also it's a passageway. Right, because every month when somebody is cycling, then the endometrium is lost with some hemorrhage through the vagina as well. All right, and so hopefully we'll have some time to look at the ovarian and uterine cycles. All right, so those are the functions of the vagina right here. And then we have some tissue, the labia. There's a minorum and a majorum right here that protect the urethral orifice and the vaginal orifice right here, right? And labium is just another name for lips, and that helps form the vulva. The vulva of the female is the orifices of the vagina, the urethra, the clitoris, as well as both labia right here. All right, and that forms a little vestibule or chamber. Okay, so that's an important exam figure. Make sure you know that. And here's another important exam figure. All right, so we can see the vagina, the lateral fornices. Here clearly you can see the external os and the internal os. These are the openings right into the cervical canal, the layers of the uterus. And you can see the lumen, the fundus. All right, what does that remind you of? When somebody says, yeah, the stomach, right? So you should know that that most anterior part, no, the most superior part of the stomach is called the fundus. And then here's the body of the uterus. And if you can think to back when you were doing dissection, if you're doing a fetal pig and had a female fetal pig, notice that there's a big difference between the female reproductive tract and the pig reproductive tract, because in the pig, this structure right here is called a uterine horn, which is muscular. So in the pig, this uterine horn could maintain maybe 7 pregnancies. And in the pig, this other uterine horn could maintain as many as 7 pregnancies. So that's why pigs could have up to maybe 14 piglets every time. But in the human, since we don't have uterine horns, just this uterine body right here, you usually have 1 or maybe 2 pregnancies at one time. But certainly you shouldn't have more than 2, because there's just not a lot of room in the uterus to maintain all those pregnancies. All right, and then there was a case in the news last year where somebody got really carried away. How many pregnancies did they have? Yeah, had 8 pregnancies in here, and it's just amazing that everybody went to term. Well, they didn't go to term. They were delivered, not vaginally, but by cesarean section prematurely. But as far as we know, they didn't have any developmental deficits because they were so crowded in there. Okay, so here you can see the ovary, and it's held in place by a couple ligaments. Here's the ovarian ligament, and then here is the broad ligament, which goes from the body of the uterus, and it also holds the fallopian tube in place and the ovaries. Okay, the parts of this fallopian tube. The wide open part right here is called the infundibulum, right? And then there is kind of a wide area that we call the ampulla, and then it kind of shrinks down. Where it shrinks down, we call that the isthmus of the fallopian tube. And then here's that fimbriated edge of the fallopian tube. And if you look at this fallopian tube in this aspect right here, it should remind you of a musical instrument. What musical instrument does that remind you of? A flute, that's close. But does a flute have a big broad end, a flared end?
No.
Flute is kind of straight. It kind of reminds you of a trumpet. That's good. I like trumpet. Maybe clarinet or trumpet, because you see this end right here, the infundibulum is kind of flared open. And indeed, years ago, it was named the Thalpinx, which means trumpet. All right, so maybe somebody is reading their reproductive tract system. That's great. Or was that a pre-lecture reading assignment question? Thalpinx? I'm not sure. Okay. All right, so Thalpinx is the name for this fallopian tube. And if somebody has a history of pelvic inflammatory disease and they're having trouble getting pregnant, or they're concerned about ectopic pregnancies, sometimes you would like to take a nice picture of this fallopian tube or the Thalpinx right here, along with a nice picture of the inside of the uterus, so they can inject some kind of contrast agent, right, and take an x-ray, and you get an x-ray of the internal compartment of the fallopian tube and the uterus right here, because you can see if there's blockages, right? Normally it should be what? Completely open. That contrast agent should go everywhere. You should find a nice picture of it, and that's called a histosalpingogram, right? Because what's the name of a fallopian tube? It's the Thalpinx. Right? Okay. All right, so that's pretty good for the female reproductive system, except for this ovary right here. We can see some structures inside that ovary, so let's take a look at this ovary. All right, so the job of an ovary is not to produce sperm, but to produce oocytes, right, which can be fertilized to make an embryo. Okay. All right, so before a woman is born, there are germ cells that produce about 2 million primary follicles. So this all happens before you're born, and then when you're born, that process stops. So the maximum number of babies a woman could ever have is 2 million, because you won't ever produce any more primary oocytes after you're born. But is that okay? Who wants to have more than 2 million babies in here anyway? Nobody, right? So that's kind of unlike the male, because in the male, spermatogenesis will take place through the whole life of the male. So that's a little bit different. All right? And then as you move from birth to puberty, about 1 million of these primary oocytes die. Okay? And then through the rest of your reproductive life, right, maybe a couple thousand will actually mature to become an oocyte that can undergo fertilization. All right, so this process does not happen through your whole lifetime if you're a female. Most of the development takes place before you're born. Okay. But once a month, one of these primary follicles, under the control of the endocrine system, starts to mature. All right, so here is what we call a follicle with an oocyte in there, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And at this point in time, we call this a mature follicle or a Graafian follicle with a mature oocyte on the inside. And under the proper control of the endocrine system, this oocyte is ovulated from the ovary. And that can produce a little mild hemorrhage as well. All right, so we see like three main areas of this follicle. There is the antrum that's filled with fluid, follicular fluid, and then there are these fecal cells right here. It's the job of these fecal cells to secrete estrogen. All right, so if it's very early on in the ovarian cycle, you don't have very many fecal cells over here. And these are the cells that are secreting estrogen. All right, so how much estrogen is being secreted by these developing follicles? Just a little bit, because you don't have a lot of fecal cells. But as that follicle gets big, you have a lot more fecal cells. Guess what happens to estrogen levels? They go up, because now you have thousands and thousands of more cells secreting estrogen from this fecal layer right here. Okay, so we're going to take a look at some of these hormone levels. Now, when this egg is ovulated, okay, these fecal cells don't die right away. They become this structure right here. And that structure, it should look a little yellow. It's called the corpus luteum, right? Which is another very important endocrine structure in the female. And the job of the corpus luteum, okay, got to make sure you write this down, is to secrete progesterone. All right, so the question is, what cells or what structure releases estrogen in the female? It's these fecal cells of a maturing follicle, and as the follicle gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it secretes more and more estrogen. All right, but not very much progesterone. Okay, and then ovulation takes place, and that follicle doesn't degenerate. It becomes another important endocrine gland, which is what we call the corpus luteum, and now those cells stop secreting estrogen, and what do they primarily secrete? Progesterone. Okay, so estrogen and progesterone come from these different cells within the ovary. Okay, so now let's think about the male. Where does testosterone come from? The testes, but what part of the testes? Remember, the testes has these tubes that are making sperm. It's those Leydig cells, which are the interstitial cells, the ones that are outside the tubules, in between the seminiferous tubules, are secreting testosterone. And there is no analog in the male for progesterone. Okay, testosterone is kind of the opposite of estrogen in the male and female, but the male has nothing comparable to progesterone, because guess what? Where they got that name from? Progesterone. Gesterone. Something. Gestation. What does gestation mean? It means when somebody's pregnant, when that embryo and fetus is developing in the uterus. Okay, that's gestation, which typically is how long?
9 months,
okay? So progesterone is a hormone which promotes gestation. So it's a hormone that's at high levels to maintain the uterus, but also to make it very nice and quiet, to keep the irritability down. Because what would happen if it was maybe midterm and the uterus got very irritable and started contracting? Yeah, that might expel the pregnancy, right? So progesterone makes the muscle really strong in the uterus and keeps it quiet so that pregnancy is maintained. So that's progesterone. So when progesterone is high, the uterus is big and strong, okay, and the female body thinks what? That it is pregnant, right? When progesterone is high, that triggers everything to thinking that the female is pregnant. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we can talk about parturition in a little bit, but progesterone might maintain itself pretty high all through gestation, but there's another hormone that kicks in called oxytocin, okay? And that oxytocin is controlled by the fetus. Maybe if we have time, I can talk about parturition just a little bit, okay? All right, so I want to relate some of these structures and the endocrine control of what's happening. All right, so where are we looking? Like, that's not a bad slide. That's not a bad slide. I wish I had them together. Let's start with this one. Okay, so we're looking at a representation of two places in the female body. We're looking inside the ovary, right, and we're looking at the development of a follicle in the ovary versus time. And we're looking over a period of 28 days. And you might be familiar with that 28-day cycle. Sometimes we call that the menstrual cycle. But inside the female body, there are two structures that are changing over this period of time. And one structure is the ovary, because look at what's happening with this follicle right here. Okay? The second structure is the uterus. And primarily what we're looking at is the endometrium of the uterus, not the myometrium or the perimetrium, but the endometrium of the uterus. So can you picture where these two slides are coming from? One is the ovary, which you looked at already, and also then the uterus, but just the endometrium of the uterus. Okay, let's look at the uterine cycle first. Day one starts with menstrual flow, right, with menses. That's day one, and that can last for up to 5 days. So from day one to day five, we call that the menstrual phase of the uterine cycle. And during that period of time, the endometrium shrinks and is lost and is expelled through the vagina with some hemorrhage as well. Okay. Then the next phase starts. We call this the proliferative phase. What does it mean to proliferate? It means to grow. Yeah, what kind of process are you aware of where you can start with one cell and then all of a sudden you got two cells and then four cells and then 8 and 16? What's that called? That's mitosis. So during the proliferative phase, the cells of the endometrium undergo mitosis, right? And so the endometrium gets larger and larger and larger, and these blood vessels start to grow up into the endometrium, and we start to have some of these little folds in the endometrium, okay? Until right about day 14. Now, what's interesting about day 14 compared to day number 28? Where's day 14? Right smack in the middle, okay? And right smack in the middle is where ovulation takes place. Now, ovulation doesn't have anything to do with the uterus. It has to do with the ovary, right? So we're going to compare the uterine cycle with the ovarian cycle a little bit, all right? But on day 14, ovulation takes place, and then the uterus switches from a proliferative phase to what we call the secretory phase. It still grows a little bit, but it matures. The blood, the vascularity still grows, right? Because implantation should take place in the endometrium that embryo will need a blood supply. But the endometrium also starts to secrete some compounds that will aid in implantation. And I don't know very much about those fluids that are secreted from the endometrium, and as a matter of fact, nobody might know a whole lot about those fluids yet either. But nonetheless, the endometrium secretes some kinds of compound that aid in implantation. Okay. So we call that the secretory phase, and then the secretory phase persists until, if there's no pregnancy, until day one when menses starts again. All right, so the uterine cycle has three phases. What are the three phases of the uterine cycle? Menses, right? Menstrual phase, proliferative phase, and secretory phase. Now, what part of the uterus is undergoing these changes? The endometrium, just the endometrial layer. Okay. All right. So what's helping control that? There are hormones from these follicles that control changes in the uterus. All right. So on day one, we have a primary follicle, and it starts to grow and develop. All right. And the fecal cells start to grow and proliferate. What's the hormone that is being secreted by these fecal cells? Estrogen. So it's estrogen that controls this proliferative phase of the uterine cycle. So maybe you could just draw a little arrow from these fecal cells down to the proliferative phase right here. That's what estrogen is controlling. All right, so again, where does estrogen come from? The organ is the ovary, and the cells are the fecal cells. Okay. Then right at day 14, that mature follicle ovulates an egg, and these cells, right, the leftover follicle doesn't degenerate right away. It just changes its nature completely. It becomes, instead of a follicle, it becomes the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum then stops secreting estrogen and starts to secrete the second hormone, which is progesterone. Right? So the secretory phase of the uterine cycle is controlled by progesterone. All right, and if fertilization of this egg right here does not take place, the corpus luteum will only stay viable for about, a week to 2 weeks, maybe about 10 days or so, and then it starts to regress and die. And as it regresses and dies, guess what happens to progesterone? It goes down, and when progesterone goes down, that's a signal for menses to begin. Okay? So this menstrual phase is controlled by decreasing levels of progesterone. All right, so maybe let's look at that once again. Proliferative phase. Oh, well, the three phases of the uterine cycle, you got the menstrual phase, proliferative, and secretory phase, the three phases. The proliferative phase is controlled by what hormone? Estrogen from a mature follicle, a maturing follicle, namely those fecal cells. Okay. And then that mature follicle goes away abruptly, like in a blink of an eye. What do we call that? Ovulation. So now that follicle is no longer a follicle, it becomes the corpus luteum, and the corpus luteum reduces its secretion of estrogen and starts to secrete progesterone, and then that produces the secretory phase of the uterus and the endometrium. All right, so that puts the final touches of development into the endometrium for implantation to take place. All right, so that's the full uterine cycle with the ovarian cycle right here. All right, so we talked about some hormones that control this. So here is pretty much the whole picture. Let's relate this together with the male and female reproductive system because you got some questions of this. So we're going to go over some of this. The hypothalamus controls the anterior pituitary. The hypothalamus releases hormones that can cause the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary. So in terms of the reproductive system, I want you to know what the name of that hormone is that controls the anterior pituitary. Can you picture where that hypothalamus is? Right, it's on the base of the brain, right above the pituitary gland, right above the cella turcica, right above the sphenoid, okay? So the hypothalamus secretes something that we call capital G, little n, RH. That stands for gonadotropin-releasing hormone. Because what's a gonad? What's a gonad? It's the primary reproductive structure, so either a testes or an ovary, right? That's a gonad. And gonadotropin-releasing hormone, this is a hormone that's going to cause the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary that are going to go to the gonads, the ovaries or testes. All right, so GnRH stimulates the anterior pituitary to increase the secretion of two other hormones. One is called follicle-stimulating hormone. And guess what the job of follicle-stimulating hormone is? It stimulates a follicle. And I'm going to put, so here is male, here is female down over here. So we got two different tracks. All right, so follicle-stimulating hormone is going to work on a primary follicle to do what? To make it mature. Okay, it's going to make it grow. And as that primary follicle is growing, what is it secreting? Estrogen, right? It's secreting estrogen. All right. Secreting estrogen. We'll get back to that in a second. All right. FSH, when it goes to the testes right here, it's going to cause this germ cell to make a spermatocyte. All right, so follicle-stimulating hormone is responsible for making either sperm cells or egg cells, right, because it's going to make that primary follicle grow. So follicle-stimulating hormone makes these, what we call, gametes grow. Gamete is either a sperm or an egg, makes them develop. All right. The other hormone that we have is called LH, luteinizing hormone. LH in the male goes to an interstitial cell, and what does that interstitial cell do? Another name for an interstitial cell is Leydig cell. It produces testosterone. All right, and that testosterone also helps the sperm mature. So testosterone is important for maturation of a sperm cell, plus, right, it's necessary to maintain all the other male structures in the body. All right. LH in the female really works on a mature follicle, and particularly at day 14. What happens during day 14 of the ovarian cycle? Something special. There is this big spike in LH which causes a mature follicle to ovulate. Okay, so now you got an egg and you got a sperm. That's what you want under the control of these hormones right here. All right, so after ovulation, then what happens to this mature follicle? What does it become? The corpus luteum. All right, and the corpus luteum secretes a hormone, not estrogen. Estrogen is coming from follicles, developing follicles, but where does progesterone, what does a corpus luteum secrete? Progesterone. Okay. All right, so the body thinks it's pregnant. Progesterone goes back to the hypothalamus and it turns off the hypothalamus because there's no reason why a woman needs to produce another egg if they're pregnant. Okay, so the progesterone not only works on the uterus to make it grow and get big and strong and start secreting, it also turns the brain off from thinking that it wants to produce another egg. Okay? Corpus luteum. Okay, and what's the job of progesterone? Where does it go? goes to the uterus, right? And makes the endometrium nice and strong and develops for implantation. But progesterone is also necessary if implantation does occur. Let's look at the picture once again. So what should happen to the endometrium if there is implantation at this point right here? Should it be lost with menstrual flow? No, then menses should be stopped and the endometrium should be maintained throughout pregnancy, right? So there should be high levels of progesterone. All right. Now the thing is, this corpus luteum has a tendency to degenerate after about 10 days or 2 weeks, in which case then progesterone is going to decline. But what if pregnancy does take place right here? Guess what develops within the endometrium if implantation takes place? And you had to learn this structure for your fetal circulation. What is the structure that's acting like the lungs?
The
placenta. Okay, so here we have the placenta in the endometrium. Maybe I'll draw that on the board. All right, so after, without implantation, the corpus luteum goes away. But with implantation, what develops?
Placenta.
And that means what? There's a pregnancy, a viable pregnancy. All right, so here we got placenta. All right, the corpus luteum is going to go away, but the corpus luteum is responsible for progesterone. That's responsible for maintaining the uterus, right? But if the corpus luteum dies after about 2 weeks, what happens to the fetus and the placenta? It's going to die, okay? So as the placenta develops, it sends a signal to the corpus luteum to not degenerate, but to maintain itself. And that signal is a nice chemical signal that's called, I'll probably have to write it out, but I'll just abbreviate it. It's called HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin. So the placenta releases human chorionic gonadotropin that maintains the corpus luteum. So the corpus luteum does what? It doesn't degenerate. It keeps secreting progesterone. It keeps the uterus nice and healthy so that the fetus can continue to develop. All right, so human chorionic gonadotropin. What's a gonad again? Ovary, right? Or testes or ovary. So this is a gonadotropin because it goes where? Where do you find a corpus luteum? In the ovary, which is a gonad. So it sort of makes sense that these things should be labeled that way. And if you're interested in finding out if you're pregnant, you can get a little chemical test from the drugstore, and you put some urine on it, and guess what that little test is measuring? Human chorionic gonadotropin. If it's pregnant, it means what? There's a placenta. Okay, and guess what should happen to this human chorionic gonadotropin level every day? Placenta gets bigger a little bit every day. The amount of HCG increases a little bit every day. That means, what can you tell me about the placenta? It's growing, it's viable. If HCG starts to decrease, what does that tell you about the placenta?
Dying.
It's going away. If the placenta is dying and going away, what should you think of? They used to hang that sign in the emergency rooms. Think ectopic. That's right. So it's really easy to tell. It's really easy to manage if somebody has an ectopic pregnancy because this HCG hormone should increase every day. If it levels out and starts to go down, right, if your OBGYN is tracking this, then you got to be concerned about an ectopic pregnancy. You got to take it seriously. So I think that answered your question about... Somebody asked me about progesterone and what controls progesterone secretion. That corpus luteum secretes it. That's right. And if implantation takes place, then the placenta releases HCG to keep that corpus luteum alive. And if no implantation takes place, the corpus luteum goes away. You probably don't have to know what that's called. It's called the corpus albicans. It's just a little degenerative cyst in the ovary. And eventually it gets resorbed too, hopefully. There's no class Monday. And I'll... Wednesday. Today's Monday. And Wednesday is the first day of finals week, so there's no class. So this was the last lecture.
Okay.
Absolutely. I'll have to post them in Blackboard. There's special office hours during finals week. I have them posted on my door. So if you want to go by my door right now, yeah, I have them posted. But I'll put them in Blackboard. When is the final?
Monday,
May 24th.